Anglican priest and controversialist, Father Rod Bauer. Rod, welcome. It's great to have you with us on Sunday night.
I've been with you,
very anxious to chat with you for a long time. For those of you who sort of recognise the name vaguely, Rod's the one responsible for all those signs on his church in Gosford, like, "Dear Christians, some people are gay, get over it, love God." Rod, first of all, what prompted you to start that sort of signage? Because there was a tradition, wasn't there, in Sydney on Broadway, St Barnabas Broadway, for many years in Sydney.
And the pub used across
to run,
the road.
And used to have that argument with the pub across the road with signage week by week. Is there some little sort of hint of that there in your background?
Oh, I was always aware of the Broadway sign. Our particular sign, it had been up for ages. We just had the normal church things on it. And I was invited to give the last rites to a man who was dying. His sister had called me, and so I went to the house and discovered the man in one of those hospital beds in the lounge room. You know, he's obviously final stages of cancer, and I asked if he lived there alone, and there was this awkward silence, and then I asked if he had a partner, and there was an even more awkward silence, and I said, "Is his partner here?" And they said, "Oh, yes." And I said, "Well, you want to bring him out so we can be part of this." And it was just the assumption that, and I don't blame the family at all, but it's just the culture that took them to the assumption that because I was a priest, that I would somehow or other have a negative view of the fact that this was a same-sex couple. And so I was so enraged at the assumption that I went straight back to the office. I marched myself down to the front and I put up that sign, "Dear Christians, some people are gay, get over it, love God." And our Facebook at that stage had about 150 likes, like most church Facebooks have. You know, 150 people feel sorry for me, so they like my Facebook. And within a week, there were 3,000. And now there's 45,000.
Positive, negative on that one?
3,000 likes. Our Facebook went to 3,000 likes. I would guess majority positive, but it brought out again that more fundamentalist Christian.
Well, because like in this context, you're stepping into a hornet's nest, because
absolutely,
you've got groups like the Australian Christian Lobby, yes, who are determined, yes, that all Orthodox Christians will be of the view that such relationships are inappropriate.
And that's a fairly loud voice.
Perhaps not consistent with the will of God.
Yes, yeah. That's a fairly loud voice. That's why the progressive voice is also so important, because it puts forward an alternative view, an alternative biblical view, an alternative theological view, and an alternative sociological view. And while the conservative voice has its place and it has its right to be expressed, it's so important the progressive voice also is heard.
Many people looking at your church and you're clad as a vicar on Sundays, looking like something out of the classic Anglo-Catholic tradition. This used to be the Conservative Party at prayer, as it was characterised in Britain.
Yes, but it was all, I guess the Anglo-Catholic tradition, though, was also an intensely incarnational tradition. That's why the material things mattered in worship, incense and bread and wine and vestments and music. And so there's always that edge to Anglo-Catholicism that doesn't really exist anymore as such, but the idea of incarnational theology.
I'd like to come back to that later. Let's go to how you got into the business of religion in the first place, because your background isn't one that people would, growing up, you would necessarily associate with somebody who goes off and becomes a high church vicar.
No, a country boy, in the Hunter Valley boy, sent to Sunday school by my parents, who weren't at all religious in any noticeable way.
And your parents were adoptive parents?
I'm an adopted person, yeah, which is, I think, an integral part to my spiritual search. I think all adopted people will...
The who am I question.
Say, who am I? Yeah. Where is my... It's a search for identity. And part of my offering in that early stage for priesthood was a search for identity. It comes with a ready-made. It comes with a title and a uniform and a spot. A
that's
seat.
That's right, Pitt.
That's where I that's where I find my identity.
So why was it the church?
It could have been anything.
Yeah. I woke up one Christmas. I was 20, so I'd graduated from church at 12 when I was confirmed, like you do. And went off to, I started work at 15 and spent those years in quite a self-destructive search for identity. And then I woke up one Christmas Day, 1982, and thought, well, it's Christmas Day, you know. And literally what I said to myself was, a bloody man should go to church, should do the right thing, go to church. So I got up and went to church and I was captured. I went to a parish that was quite an old-fashioned pre-Vatican II Anglo-Catholic parish. It was the church I was baptised in. My parents were married there, and I'd never been back in through the door since I was 6 months old. And I was captured by the otherness of the liturgy, the transcendence of it.
So it was the liturgy that got you. The rite,
yes,
that got you.
It was the liturgy that captured my imagination. And so I went back the next week. And kept going back and, became more involved. And then people started to say, you really ought to be a priest. And I sort of laughed in their face, really, because, I was a rich young man.
What were you doing as a trade, as a business?
My family were in the meat industry from farm graziers, because where I grew up in the country. And my father was actually a butcher. My mother's family owned the grazing properties. My father's family were in retail butchery. And so there was a melding of,
vertical integration.
There was a synergy there. And so that was the context in which I grew up. And I went to work in that industry. And so eventually I said to people, well, I'll shut you up. I'll go to the bishop and I'll say, everyone tells me I should be a priest, and he'll laugh me out of his office and that'll be it. And he didn't. And then I thought, what am I going to do now? Because then you go to what's called a selection conference. I thought, well, they'll work it out and they'll throw me out. And they didn't. And then, so I kept being carried along in this wave, thinking that eventually this will all fall apart and I'll just go back to what I've been doing. And nearly 30 years later, I'm still doing it.
And still getting meaning out of it. And still,
real meaning now, yeah, I think. Maybe not in the early part, but certainly real meaning now.
Yeah, was there a moment when you say, okay, well, I'm going along this way, it'll all become clear to me soon, God will reveal himself. And you get to a point where you think, hang on, something's got to shift here. Was there a shifting gears moment where you became the Rod Bauer that we recognise now as being prepared to put up signs on his church notice board as the one we've described?
I think there was a moment when I accepted that this is real, this is where I belong, and that was certainly as my ordination as a deacon. We were sitting in the side chapel. Before the ordination, there was three candidates, and the other two were in deep prayer, and I was counting the bricks on the wall and thinking, what am I doing here? And out we go, and then the bishop laid his hands on my head, and he ordained me a deacon, and I just knew at that very moment, this is my place, this is who I am.
Mm.
And I, whilst I've tried to get out on a number of occasions over those 30 years, I've never really doubted that my vocation is to the priesthood.
What gives it meaning to you today?
It's the same thing that's always given it meaning, is the meaning that it has for the people that we encounter.
You mentioned incarnation earlier, and yes, for those not familiar with it, incarnation is really the presence of Jesus in the world.
Yes. To take on flesh.
Yeah.
Yes. So and to be, to be the, sometimes, not to put too fine a point on it, but to be those hands and that face. And
there's
that
a little
presence.
Sunday school poem I remember, he has no hands but our hands, yeah, his sacred work to do. Yeah. It's that sort of, yeah, view on what religion's, yeah, about. It's a this-worldly, yeah, take on religion.
Yeah. And for me, faith. It's often it's the marginalised, it's the homeless, it's the people sleeping on our veranda, it's I'm privileged to also be a juvenile justice chaplain and to work with the detainees who are marginalised people, and I guess some of the social justice stuff we do at the moment is certainly, you know, reaching out to those people that society pushes to the edge.
How much of you was shaped by Leonard Cohen?
May he rest in peace.
And yes, you've taken perhaps his best known song, Alleluia, and given us a Rod Bauer spin on it. Introduce us.
So I'd always appreciated the melody. It's almost a plain song melody in some way of Cohen's Alleluia. And I thought one day I really want to write something, a hymn or something that goes with that music, because everyone knows it, everyone can sing it, you know. And one night I sat down and I wrote the Beatitudes lyrics, and it came to me in less than an hour, fully formed.
Let's have a listen. Rod Bauer, Leonard Cohen. Music of Leonard Cohen, the thoughts of Father Rod Bauer. Rod Bauer, let's talk about the cheekiness of that first sign. Others that are famous more recently, Pauline, How About Lunch? We like that. There's a cheekiness here that you haven't let go, and you've made part of your expression as a clergyman, yet it's discomforting. Even discombobulating to some in the congregation, and indeed more in the church,
in the wider community, I'd have to say, outside of the church, it's what we call the prophetic ministry. I mean, and in that sense of the 8th century prophets who wander into town and they look around, they're really social commentators, and they basically say, you know, if you keep behaving in this way, this is what's going to happen. Your society is going to fall apart.
In the tradition of Isaiah, Jeremiah and Amos.
And Amos and Hosea. Mm. And that's kind of the ministry I seem to have fallen into just at the moment. Now, times and seasons, it may pass.
But in a sense, it's quite extraordinary, and it's an example of the way new technology can work for us, in that there you are, a parish priest in Gosford, sort of nice Central Coast, New South Wales, lovely place. But all of a sudden, you're Rod Bauer, worldwide commentator, because your hit rate is enormous.
It's the power of social media. I mean, without social media, I would be Rod Bauer, parish priest in Gosford.
So has it changed the way you do church?
We've tried for it not to change the way we do church, to be honest, although we do.
So there's still power in the liturgy, power in the ritual, power in the rite.
Yes. Now, I've moved a long way away from the old Anglo-Catholicism of my early priesthood. I probably see myself as a modern liturgical Catholic in that sense. We've totally renovated our worship space. We have an altar in the middle. People gather around, so it's really sitting around a table rather than the priest up the front at the altar. And that says all sorts of things about a deep incarnational theology, that, you know, everybody is in the sanctuary. You know, we are sharing in a priesthood, and I just have a certain function in the middle of that. But it's important for us. So we've tried, record the sermons and they go up, and we have a very loyal following on a Sunday night on Facebook who watch the sermon. And these are often people who feel ostracized.
So your pastorate is far bigger than your congregation.
Yes. Oh, far bigger, far bigger. I, as Wesley said, the world is my parish. I'm not quite, that's probably going a bit too far. But
how many do you reckon you're preaching to on a Sunday night?
A few thousand.
Which is significant for a local congregation.
It ranges from about 8,000 to 15,000, depends on.
And how many do you get into church on Sunday?
Oh, in our parish, across the parish on a Sunday, we would get a couple of hundred.
So it magnifies your ministry enormously.
Oh, yes.
How much time do you give to thinking about that as distinct from the load of the parish work? Because in some ways they can be in tension, can't they?
Luckily, we have a great team of clergy and lay people. So, you know, much of the life of the parish goes on without, you know, my involvement in many ways. So I think I probably spend about a third of my time in parish work, and that's parish administration, funerals, weddings, Sunday mornings, knocks on the door, all of that normal parish priest stuff. Probably about a third in my role as Archdeacon of the Central Coast. Central Coast is the eighth largest region in the country.
It's entitled to be called the Venerable.
Apparently. I'm normally called the Controversial. My title is actually the Venerable. I think I should get my cards changed to the Controversial. Anyway. And then about a third of my time goes in this wider social advocacy kind of ministry.
What's the future of the church for you? I mean, like, not for you personally, but the way you perceive it. Because New South Wales, particularly those close to Sydney, this is an interesting dynamic. You talk about incarnational Christianity, the Anglo-Catholic tradition, the way it's influenced you, yet here you sit alongside the heart of another view of Christianity, a heavily Sydney Anglican, which is influenced by Calvinist Presbyterian theology. These are almost sort of diametric opposites, yet here you are in a church which tries to hold those together, not always too successfully. How do you negotiate that?
It's becoming increasingly difficult, I would have to say. But I like to see it in terms of people's stages of faith. There's a man called James Fowler who came up with this idea that there are about seven stages of faith, and this applies to, you know, any religion. And another guy, that the pop psychologist when I was back in college in the 1980s, a man called M. Scott Peck, wrote a book called The Road Less Travelled, and people of our era would probably resonate with that. He cut them back to about four stages to make it easy for people like me to understand. And there's that first quite self-centred, really, stage of, you know, what God can do for me. And there'll always be people in that stage. Mm. There'll always be churches who will be a place for those people to go.
Please give me God.
Yeah. And then there's the second stage, which is the rules and regulations. How do I fit in? How do I find my identity? And that's that most churches are stage two churches. Because churches are stage two institutions.
I've got to maintain this rigid position at all costs.
And when I think back of how I was trained as a priest, I was actually trained to keep people in stage two because that's the best business model. And most big churches are stage two churches. How do I fit in? What's the rules and regulations? And then there's that kind of stage three when you've got to go through the first two stages. You have to do that. That's part of human development. But some people get to a stage where they think, okay, I know where I fit and I kind of know what the rules and where the boundaries are, and they get more interested in what's out there in the world.
That's the comfortable with who I am stage you've got to get to, isn't it?
Yes.
In a sense, before you can actually...
Before you can look out and you get that stage three. And most, the trouble with stage three for the church is most stage three people leave the church. Yes. They don't need it anymore. And when you run,
and they're confident in their own spiritual journey, in a sense.
Yes. They may choose to stay and look out and be stage three people in a stage two world, but often they just leave, and that's a really bad business model for the church. And we run a stage three church, which is the worst possible business model for a church. And so then there's of course stage four, which is the more mystic, and you get stage four people. In all of those churches.
Yes.
You get stage four people at you know, every church.
The stage three person would be the common sort of iconic baby boomer type. That is, grew up in church, concerned enough about it to want to bring their families up, but once their kids get old enough to move on or get married, they'll turn around and say, what am I doing here?
Yes.
And it's that 50-year-old who sort of all of a sudden finds there is a life outside the church. And for many years, the church used to utterly depend on that generation.
Yes.
And that's the generation that's moving on.
And it's also symptomatic of postmodernism. It's the rejection of institutions. And so you ask what the future of the church is. I don't know whether in 50 years' time, there'll always be stage one, two. My real interest is what will stage three and stage four churches look like, and in particular stage four, which is the mystic stage. And what we know as we study the history of spirituality, is when humanity goes through a time of fundamentalism, and that's kind of extreme stage two stuff.
I'm as mad as hell.
Yeah, and then what comes out of that are the mystics. They start to emerge out of. We see this in the 14th century. Julian of Norwich and John of the Cross, and these people sort of start to emerge, the mystics. And I think what I find particularly interesting is what will emerge out of this time of Islamic fundamentalism. And I think we look particularly to Sufism for this, the mystics. How are the Muslim mystics going to emerge out of this time of fundamentalism? And I find that fascinating. Mm. And I think that's the future. That's the answer to the long term answer to some of these very difficult questions.
If you look at Donald Trump and his recent elevation, you see the support from Christian fundamentalists didn't evaporate from him. In a way, their cultural world was dependent on that frame that you've talked about, and he represents the reinforcement of that frame. Yet at the same time, you are seeing around the world the beginning of the fracturing of that model. People are saying, I've had enough of it.
It's a kind of last, I hope, it's kind of a last gasp of some of that kind of view. The light bulb gets brighter before it goes out kind of idea. I think some of this kind of the nationalism that is sweeping the world at the moment, both in the Western world and in the Arab world, it's even ISIS is really an extreme form of nationalism, the demonising of the other, and all of this kind of stuff.
The fear of the modern.
It burns itself out.
The interesting thing is, and you're representing an incarnational way of Christianity that seems to be also reflective of. If I take Pope Francis as a model, he seems to be doing an interesting thing. He's basically saying it's the way we express ourselves in the world, in our action, that's critical. I'm not going to be fussed about the doctrinal stuff. Yes. That stands there. But it's being who we are authentically that matters, hence I will wash the feet of Muslim women prisoners. But it's also global in that it actually recaptures the sense of the common humanity, that we're all in the lifeboat together. Hence you can get Laudato Si on the environment coming out of a man who says it's the way we behave. This is the micro and the macro at the same time. Do you see that the incarnational model is the secret to that? That's what turns the key in the lock in a way?
So what we believe is important, and as someone who's deeply involved in interfaith dialogue, the fact that, you can't have interfaith dialogue unless you are very clear about what you believe and where you stand doctrinally. So that's important. But how we believe is in at the moment, in the world as it stands today, how we believe
how it's expressed
is crucial to this conversation. And certainly, from a Christian perspective, the idea that the divine takes on the material, and that in that sense sanctifies the material world, and highlights its importance, highlights the human other, highlights the creation that we're busily destroying at the moment. That's all about how we believe, and I think that takes on a heightened importance at times of stress that we're in at the moment.
It's an interesting take on what's called holiness. That holiness isn't so much a matter of me being pure and unsullied, it's me being utterly transparent.
Yes. Utterly transparent and utterly self, utterly who we are, in transparent and honest and just who we are in that context. And that's a very difficult human thing to be, because it requires an extraordinary vulnerability and a willingness to get fired at sometimes. But without that, you have no real opportunity to touch the other.
And that's the guts of being Jesus.
It's the guts of
Jesus
being, it's the guts of being Christian. I think it's the guts of being human.
Yeah.
And it's that tension between, you know, how do we keep ourselves safe, and yet how do we reach out and connect with another human being? And how do we live with that tension between how we want to be safe and isolated, but we also yearn for human connection? There's the paradox, there's the tension in human existence.
And you've got to be prepared to live with the tension.
And that's the problem with, I mean, someone says, you know, war isn't conflict. War is actually the absence of conflict. It's when we can't cope with the conflict anymore. We degenerate into violence. And so part of being fully human, living as a fully human person, is living in the tensions and the conflict of that, because we all don't see the world the same way. And to enter into that kind of dialogue is the most extraordinary, holy and sanctified thing.
Is that the task of the priest with the congregation? Because we talked about your virtual church, which is out there, but you've also got the sort of human dimension that is somehow, okay, the televisual dimension is one thing, but at some point the human contact is, that's a necessary ingredient.
Even in social media, though, I'd have to say we get a lot of human contact. We get people message us on Facebook and say, look, I've been following you for 12 months now. You know, I'm going to take the risk of telling you my story. And often they are stories of great pain. And it's hard to respond in the one-dimensional context of Facebook to something that is so deep and often so painful and so fragile. And sometimes this may, you know, may, if physically possible, lead to a face-to-face conversation or a phone conversation or a referral to, hey, you know, you're in Perth, maybe you might like to go and see this particular person. But human beings long for this. They'll tell their stories almost anonymously for a while until they feel safe enough to tell it face-to-face. And that's often the process that we find ourselves involved in. It's an extraordinary privilege.
And you keep, you preserve an optimistic, almost, I'm excited by life demeanour.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's, someone asked me the other day what's being fully alive for you, because I think that's who we see Jesus as, the person that is fully alive in that human sense, and perhaps the Christian, if not human, quest is for that. And what keeps me full? I say that I'm never more fully alive than when I'm in the pulpit, because something happens there. I Often I'm not even conscious of what I'm saying. There's something going on. There was one of the Australian surrealist artist James Gleeson, who for a little time lived and worked at the Broadwater Hotel in Gosford, believe it or not. And he was a biographer for my great uncle, who was Sir William Dobell. And
your great uncle?
Yes, yes.
Now, see, you've introduced something else. There's a track we can't go down.
Sorry,
you're going to have to come back sometime. All right, James Gleeson.
He painted this painting. It hangs in the New South Wales Art Gallery. And I used to have this recurring dream when I was a kid. And it was a surreal dream. It had no form. It was full of weird things. And I walked into the New South Wales Art Gallery, and here was my dream hanging on the wall. And it was a painting by James Gleeson called The Arrival of Implacable Gifts. And so, you know, when, you know, what little gifts I have get a chance to be exercised and let off the leash, that's when I feel fully alive.
Rod Bauer, thanks so much for joining us on Sunday
Night.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.